Want to hook up tonight? Ratu is a 22-year-old college student at an Ivy League university. She's the daughter of a doctor and a computer programmer, both Indian immigrants whose years of hard work have paid off in an upmarket lifestyle. Ratu spent 12 years in the highly competitive public schools of New York City and now hopes to follow her mother into medicine. I met Ratu's mother at a friend's going away party. When I told her the subject of my book, she urged me to interview her daughter. What I hear from my daughter, it's just unbelievable. So bleak the way these children treat each other. You really want to know what's going on? You should talk to her. I can't get my head around it. I knew I had to meet Ratu, and I did. Bright and articulate, she was like a spokesperson for one of those generations with a letter attached to it. X or Y or whatever they're up to now. She gave me an illuminating description of the sexual scene on campus. We don't really have time to date, so the quick fix is the Friday or Saturday night hookup. You go to a party or you go to a bar, everyone gets drunk, really drunk, and everyone pairs off. It's over and done with by the time Monday rolls around, after everyone has shared hookup stories over lunch. Hookup is a sort of broad term that covers everything from just fooling around to oral sex to full-on sex. The ideal college relationship is the friends with benefits scenario. You have a close male friend who you have a lot of fun with and with whom there's a bit of sexual tension. It starts one night when you're both drunk and run into each other at a bar or something. You go home together, have sex, great or not so great, it doesn't matter, and then pretend it didn't happen. The next week, this is repeated with the same person, and so on and so forth, until you feel as though you don't need the pretense of going out and getting drunk. Instead, you just call him when you feel like hooking up or if you're just bored. This is what Ratu and her friends unapologetically refer to as the booty call. There is an emotional downside even to this stunningly abbreviated form of coupling. There comes a point, Ratu says, when one party gets more involved than the other and it's time for the uncomfortable talk. Ground rules are established. This is simply a friends with benefits scenario, nothing more, nothing less. And if he or she isn't okay with that, then it's over. And then you move on to another friend. We try very hard not to let our emotions get in the way, says Ratu without a trace of irony. What's interesting for me in Ratu's description is that there's no arc to this narrative, no ascending plot, no unfolding, no climax, no closure. In fact, there's no story to the story at all. Sex is separated from the story that brought it into being. There is a deliberate attempt to keep emotions out of sex, and not just for the boys, Ratu elaborates. The girls, as well as the boys, speak of love on one hand and sex on the other, as though they have nothing to do with each other. She pauses. Though I suspect that a lot of my girlfriends would rather be in relationships, whether or not they want to admit it. Far be it from me to disparage the liberating expression of casual or recreational sex. An erotic encounter can span a range of interpersonal intensities without being disaffiliated. But this particular type of sexual activity seems less an expression of liberation than an acting out of underlying anxiety. To my surprise, Ratu agreed with this idea completely. The drinking and the sex, of course they go together. They're both things we know we're not supposed to be doing. As I listened to Ratu, I wondered how this new sociology of sex would manifest itself later in their committed relationships. What about love and marriage? I asked her. Does that ever come up? We see commitment as a life sentence. I know, especially for many of my male friends, it's a terrifying thought. They can't imagine having the same sexual partner for more than a week, let alone 10 years. Then Ratu says more seriously, for the women, it's different. They can see the appeal. Some really seem to want it, though a lot of us take on the stereotypical male fear and see monogamy as a restriction. Commitment means sacrificing your own goals and ambitions for something that you can't control and that you could potentially fail at. At least that's how we think of it now. Relationships are a loss of independence. When you let another person in romantically, you make less room for yourself. So relationships are about what you lose, not what you gain, I ask, Exactly. And romance? Huh. There was none in high school. The few couples here at college stand out as almost weird, like they're married or something. I'm intrigued by Ratu's portrayal of relationships. It had always seemed to me that coupling, or at least the dream of romance, enlarges us and is about what you can discover with someone. At least I was convinced of that at her age. Ratu and her friends seem to find more security in an MBA than in the power of a sustaining, loving bond. Why do they feel this way? One reason might be that having embraced the cultural mandate of self-reliance, they are apprehensive about relationships. If you add love to sex, you make yourself extremely vulnerable, she tells me. I think that might be the heart of the issue for my whole generation, this lack of trust. We were taught to rely on ourselves and not to depend on others. It's an unromantic attitude, but perhaps a wise one, given the precariousness of modern marriage. Gender equality is made manifest in all its irony. Both men and women now have the right to be terrified of commitment. Better to engage in risky sex than to succumb to the risks of the heart. Nothing is more useless than predicting the future for someone who's not interested in hearing it. But sometimes I can't resist, so I ventured an insight with Ratu. You're making me think that maybe this is why so many of the couples I see have such a hard time having hot sex with the one they love. It's not just your generation. This entire culture is profoundly uncomfortable with vulnerability and dependency. Good intimate sex requires both. Maybe, Ratu says. But who says good sex has to be intimate? What if good means throw me against the wall, ravish me, and leave before I wake up in the morning? It's the spontaneity I love. It's the excitement that comes with the spontaneity and the multiple partners and the dream dates where nothing goes wrong because after brunch the next day you say goodbye and you don't stick around long enough to see each other's flaws. I go through periods of being addicted to that excitement. But I also go through periods when I recognize how superficial it all is and I want a deeper connection with someone. I've had boyfriends and it's nice, though it gets a little boring. Hopefully somewhere in there I'll find a healthy balance, if I haven't already spoiled myself to the point of dissatisfaction with long-term relationships. Far from being the last word on free love, all this bravado belies an underlying unease. I wonder to what extent this kind of hit-and-run sex is actually a defense against sexual discomfort, in much the same way that taboo-ridden avoidance is a defense. It's the flip side of the coin. Same anxiety, different response. They get drunk, have sex, then pretend it never happened. It's a way of doing it without being in it. It all just happens. No one has to own it. Perhaps these pretend libertines are not nearly as removed from the Puritan legacy as their Saturday night romps would lead us to believe. Their furtive encounters are not exactly a celebration of the pleasures of the flesh. If there wasn't at least a shred of moral dissonance in their desire for sex, they might not need to get hammered in order to have it. If they were more comfortable with sex, they would actually place themselves in the heart of it and would want to remember it. For Ratu, the excitement born of spontaneity is ensured as long as she changes partners frequently enough. But what will happen to her when she's left with only one? I may never meet Ratu again, but many of the people who come to see me remind me of her. They have found that their history of sexual nomadism is no help in meeting the challenge of sustaining sexual vitality with one person over time. They view sex before marriage and sex after marriage as entirely different realities. Single sex isn't supposed to prepare you for committed sex. If anything, it's seen as the last hurrah before a lifetime of sexual decline. How important is sex anyway? A healthy sense of erotic entitlement is built on a relaxed, generous, and unencumbered attitude toward the pleasures of the body, something our Puritan culture continues to grapple with. I witness the fallout of this ambivalence in my practice every day. Much of my work with couples involves addressing the shame and anxiety that surround people's sexuality, causing them to want to withdraw from their lovers for fear of being judged and rejected. I give permission, reduce anxiety, normalize fantasies and desires, and challenge the distortions of poor body image. Together, we excavate the secrets and the silence that accompanied their sexual upbringing, and confront the cultural and familial messages that block erotic expression. Therapy is a process of expanding sexuality by shedding inhibitions, encouraging physicality, and negotiating boundaries. Couples learn to dance step by step, and it takes as long as it takes. I met Maria when she was at the tail end of a heartbreak. She'd just spent 2 years on the West Coast with a man she thought she was going to marry, only to come home a disillusioned wreck. Her friends decided it was time for her to meet a nice man, a mensch. Enough of these himbos. For those of you unfamiliar with this new term, himbos are male bimbos sought by successful women. The friends organized a dinner party with a mission, a tasteful cover-up for a first date. It worked. For Maria, dating Nico was a re-education in the art of love, a slow unfolding that was remarkably worry-free. She didn't fall in love, she grew to love him. But a year after meeting him, she's in my office asking, "How important is sex, anyway?" I keep going back and forth. "I know you can't build a life on passion. I've tried that. My grandma used to say, 'What are you going to live on, love? Huh? You've got a lot to learn. My mother's no better. Her line is, sweetheart, passion is doomed. Take my word for it. What you need is to find someone you can live with. Someone who's like you, who shares your values. You know, money doesn't hurt either.'" I love Nico. I've never felt so secure, so trusting. And after years of being out there dating more than my share of jerks, I'm finally free to think about other things in my life. But I just don't know. I don't think we click sexually. It's an issue. Or is it? Everyone says that the sex fades anyway, no matter how steamy it is in the beginning. So how important is it, really? "You tell me," I prompt her. "You know what I tell myself? Girl, you had your fun. It's time to grow up. He's a great guy. Get over yourself." 3 years after Maria asked me the question, "How important is sex anyway?" she's back again. Evidently, she hasn't found her answer. In the beginning, she was so taken up by the thrill of security that she was able to postpone dealing with her lack of sexual responsiveness to Nico. She held out some hope that the problem would take care of itself, that one day the block would lift and everything would fall into place. Nico, for his part, is a patient man. He wasn't going to push, even though he's clearly less than jolly about their anemic sex life. Not pushing the issue is his way of forestalling rejection. In our sessions, Maria had always displayed an approach-avoidance attitude to the topic of sex. On the few occasions that she brought it up directly, it was always at the end of the hour, when there was no time left for discussion. One week, I decided to keep my foot on the gas and rev up the conversation. "Sex is hard, isn't it?" I ask her. "What do you mean? Hard to talk about or hard to do?" she answered my question with a question. "Hard to own," I replied. "It's easier for me to have sex than to talk about it." "And with Nico?" "With Nico, it's easier not to have sex than to talk about it." "Tell me." "Sex is hard. I don't want it a lot of the time, which is strange because I've always thought of myself as a sexual person. I read about women with low desire, and I don't identify with them. Even though it sounds like me lately." "Was it easier with other men?" "Oh, God, no. But in the past, I never had to talk about it. It was never something I had to work on. Either it came naturally and we clicked, or the relationship wasn't going to last anyway, so why bother? Now I'm with a man I love. I think he's beautiful. He treats me like a queen, and I don't want to have sex with him. He gets frustrated when I reject him day after day, and I don't like the fact that I'm so indifferent to sex. I'd like to think it happened when I got pregnant with our daughter. But to be honest, I was kind of relieved to have an excuse. I'm pregnant, turned into, I just had a baby, turned into, I'm nursing, turned into, I need my sleep. Truthfully, as you know, it's been a problem from the beginning." Shall we take the plunge? I'm tired of avoiding it, of waiting for something to change. I can't swap Nico for a new model. I make it work with him, or I shrivel up. Maria grew up in a working-class family, the daughter of a policeman and a substitute teacher. Religion was central, and she attended all-girl Catholic schools through high school. We never talked about sex at home. My grandma had 10 kids and never knew women could have orgasms. Can you imagine? I haven't seen my mother naked since I was 3. I've never seen my father naked. I'm the youngest of 5, and each of us rebelled in our own way, though my brothers never had to face the injunctions reserved for the girls. Maria sheds light on the pervasive all-or-nothing, feast-or-famine sexual culture in America. I was 17 when I lost my virginity, and for Catholic girls, once you've slept with one person, you might as well sleep with the whole town. And frankly, most of us did, she tells me. I know it sounds archaic, but it really was like that where I grew up. Staten Island is like a nature preserve for endangered Catholics. The message was clear. Sex is sin, unless you're married. Right, like the old adage, sex is dirty. Save it for someone you love, I say. Maria moved away, went to college, became a casting agent, and today lives in a world vastly different from that of her childhood. But all this intellectual broadening has not succeeded in dismantling the prohibitions. Carnal lust is sinful, and especially for women. Despite 20 years of brief encounters, seasonal relationships, and steady boyfriends, the vestigial messages cling obstinately to the sinews of her body with a subcutaneous tenacity. Acting liberated doesn't necessarily mean being liberated. When she was still single, Maria could circumvent her latent sexual uneasiness. It was easier to be uninhibited when she had less invested emotionally. But once she chose to live within the geographic limitations of a family, the murmurs of her past began to echo. Once every 6 months or so, I'll bring it up with Nico. I'll say, Nico, our sex life sucks. We need to do something about it. I want you to read this book. But he doesn't want to read a book. He hates those books. He'll say, it's not my thing. Let's just make some time to be together. The more sex you have, the more sex you have, right? That's his stock answer. I've recommended books to you before, but in this instance, it sounds like you're using them to hide behind. Why is it so hard for you to talk about yourself, to be your own advocate? What would happen if you said, Nico, I want to tell you about myself, what I think and feel about sex, about myself sexually. The whole subject is so emotionally overwhelming, it makes me sleepy. Maria was taught that nothing is free. Everything must be earned. Privilege is for those who've never had to work hard and it's morally suspect. The credo was, you sacrifice for the good of the family. Her reluctance to put herself forward is particularly strong in the sexual realm. It seems okay to ask for what you really need, I explain. But to ask for something just because you want it or like it is selfish. Pleasure itself, unless you've earned it, is dubious. It also raises the question of how much you feel you deserve and are worthy of receiving, just because you're you. But eroticism is precisely that. It's pleasure for pleasure's sake, offered to you gratuitously by Nico. Together, Maria and I work on cultivating a healthy sense of deserving that spans sitting down in the morning when she drinks her coffee, reading the paper while the kitchen is still dirty, and going out with her friends even if it means Nico has to spend 2 nights in a row taking care of the baby. She is to take a break from the idea that pleasure must be paid for in advance by the performance of duty. We chisel away at this complex system of fairness and merit where everything has to be perfectly equitable in order to neutralize selfishness. Maria has taken hold of this idea. I think my low desire is more than anything else related to my lack of ownership around sex and my conflict with pleasure, especially pleasure with my husband. I can't explain why I'm so uncomfortable opening myself up to Nico erotically. What I do know is that family is never where I've gone to get anything extra. Right. For you, family is about self-sacrifice, not enjoyment. But a healthy sense of entitlement is a prerequisite for erotic intimacy. Only when Maria starts to look at what she brings to the erotic stalemate does Nico's contribution become apparent. She asks him some of the same questions we have hashed out in our sessions. What does sex mean for you? How was sex treated in your family? What are the important events that shaped your sexuality? What would you like to experience most with me sexually? And what are you most afraid of? They spark conversations that are provocative and inspiring, that focus on possibilities rather than on problems. Maria learns that for Nico, sex is both liberating and connecting, an eloquent mark of love. When she rebuffs him, he feels unloved. Nico is not a talker. Instead, he expresses caring by doing things, washing the dishes, shining her shoes, always keeping chocolate in the refrigerator. He makes sure that they get out of the house on the weekend, guilt-free, which Maria finds difficult, and don't get bogged down with interminable housekeeping. He's generous with his affection, both with Maria and with their daughter. But the caresses stop when the sex starts. While he likes sex, he's less in his element with seduction. He's so eager to get to the sex part of sex, where he knows what he's doing, that he tends to gloss over the pursuit and the romance, the games, you know? I wind up feeling rushed. It takes Nico about 2 minutes to go from watching TV to being completely physically and emotionally ready to have intercourse. I need a slower build-up. And in my typical way of trying to take care of him, I don't want him to feel bad, so I try to get turned on really fast. It's a total fiasco. For Nico, sex is a play in one act. For Maria, it is a continuum of pleasures, a successive unfolding. The problem arises when they become trapped in a linear, goal-oriented focus on intercourse and orgasm that bypasses eroticism. In this setup, she struggles with the idea that lingering is implicitly selfish and shamelessly greedy. Her lack of prerogative and lack of self-affirmation are met with Nico's hurriedness, which further reinforces her notion that she is not worthy of attention. Of course, she wouldn't worry that she was taking too long if she thought he was into it. But for Nico, slowness inspires a different kind of anxiety, a fear of inadequacy that he won't perform well enough. I suggest to Maria that she and Nico liberate themselves from this task-oriented performance model of sexuality with its rigid requirements for mutual orgasm. It's a pass-fail approach that smacks of seriousness and takes much of the fun out of sex. Remember making out? I ask her. When's the last time you did that? It's been years, you know. I remember in the very beginning we spent an evening making out. French kissing on the boardwalk at Coney Island. It was amazing. We don't do that anymore. Well then, there you go. The intricacies of the dynamics between Maria and Nico are subtle, and this is true for most of the couples I meet. It's never just one thing or one partner. Maria says she wants to be seduced, yet she resists seeing Nico as seductive. My relationship stands in the way of my attraction to him. Sometimes I'll look at him, like when he gets out of the shower or comes home from the gym, and I'll think, God, he's hot. Why is he so attractive until I remember he's my husband? I explain to Maria that it's scary to be both erotically exposed and emotionally intimate with the same person, especially when you hold the belief that sex is somehow shameful. There's a whole part of you that hasn't yet entered your relationship. In fact, the psychic energy involved in keeping it tucked away is enough to make you exhausted. No wonder you'd rather go to sleep than make love to your husband. Like many of us, Maria grew up learning to hide her erotic reveries and idle daydreams. Keeping our pleasures secret is a central component of our sexual socialization. Maria recalls the shame of getting caught as a child in a delicious moment of erotic exploration, and the disgust on her mother's face as she said, "Stop that right now!" Even those of us fortunate enough to have parents who recognized that sexual play feels good are still likely to remember with a wince the admonishment, "Keep it private." It is hard to bring out in the open that which we spend years trying to hide. Not surprisingly, Maria struggles to bring into her relationship the erotic imaginings she was taught so early to suppress and defend against. Sensing Nico's receptivity, It is precisely what I encourage her to do, to own the wanting and to believe herself worthy of being cooed over. At the same time, I encourage her to bring to Nico a fresh curiosity. It's too easy to encase him in the role of husband with all the attendant domestic qualities and then complain about the lack of desire. He has a whole interior geography, and you're just hanging around in the same old neighborhood. This is the challenge of sexual intimacy, of bringing home the erotic. It is the most fearsome of all intimacies because it's so all-encompassing. It reaches the deepest places inside us and involves disclosing aspects of ourselves that are invariably bound up with shame and guilt. It is scary, a whole new kind of nakedness, far more revealing than the side of our nude bodies. When we express our erotic yearnings, we risk humiliation and rejection, which are equally devastating. I have witnessed the painful scene when a person's preferences are condemned and labeled by his or her partner as perverse, deviant, and disgusting. It's no wonder that many of us prefer the security of workable sex as a shield against this harrowing scenario. We may be far from passion, but at least we feel normal. In the grand scheme of things, it's not a bad compromise. But then, there are those who long to be known differently, to give themselves over and risk crossing that threshold. They muster the courage to confront the cultural prohibitions against sex. Exuberant sex at home. They hunger for full expression in the erotic realm and resist the urge to withhold. For them, sexual communion is far from dirty, but rather a sacred melding that puts us in touch with the divine. Erotic intimacy is the revelation of our memories, wishes, fears, expectations, and struggles within a sexual relationship. When our innermost desires are revealed and are met by our loved one with acceptance and validation, the shame dissolves. It is an experience of profound empowerment and self-affirmation for the heart, body, and soul. When we can be present for both love and sex, we transcend the battleground of Puritanism and hedonism. 7. Erotic blueprints. Tell me how you were loved, and I'll tell you how you make love. Grown-ups never understand anything for themselves, and it is tiresome for children to be always and forever explaining things to them. Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, The Little Prince. So like a forgotten fire, a childhood can always flare up again within us. Gaston Bachelard. A host of institutions look out for our best interest. Religion, government, medicine, education, the media, and pop culture all labor tirelessly to define and regulate the parameters of our sexual well-being. The incentives and prohibitions surrounding the voluptuousness of the body are the mother's milk of society. Much of what we learn about sex comes from the street, the movies, television, and school. But before any of these reach us, our family gets us first. We are members of a society, but we're also the children of our parents. This includes grandparents, step-parents, guardians, foster parents, and anyone else who is entrusted with our early well-being. No history has a more lasting effect on our adult loves than the one we write with our primary caregivers. The archaeology of desire. The psychology of our desire often lies buried in the details of our childhood, and digging through the early history of our lives uncovers its archaeology. We can trace back to where we learned to love and how. Did we learn to experience pleasure or not? To trust others or not? To receive or be denied? Were our parents monitoring our needs or were we expected to monitor theirs? Did we turn to them for protection? Or did we flee them to protect ourselves? Were we rejected, humiliated, abandoned? Were we held, rocked, soothed? Did we learn not to expect too much, to hide when we are upset, to make eye contact? In our family, we sense when it's okay to thrive and when others might be hurt by our zest. We learn how to feel about our body, our gender, and our sexuality. And we learn a multitude of other lessons about who and how to be, to open up or to shut down, to sing or to whisper, to cry or to hide our tears, to dare or to be afraid. All these experiences shape our beliefs about ourselves and our expectations for others. They are part of the dowry each man and woman brings to adult love. Part of this emotional scorecard is obvious and manifest, but much of it is unspoken, concealed, even from ourselves. Our sexual preferences arise from the thrills, challenges, and conflicts of our early life. How these bear on our threshold for closeness and pleasure is the object of our excavation. What turns you on and what turns you off? What draws you in? What leaves you cold? Why? How much closeness can you stand to feel? Can you tolerate pleasure with the one you love? When Stephen's father abandoned his mother, she picked up the pieces, devoted herself to caring for her children, and swore she would never let anyone hurt her like that again. An ER nurse, today she owns her own home and has put 3 kids through college. Stephen is filled with admiration and respect for his mother, and has spent much of his life guarding against becoming what he calls that asshole. 6 years into his marriage to Rita, he finds himself avoiding her overtures and ducking her accusations about his sexual passivity. Behind his excuses, Stephen is baffled by his lack of interest and by his unreliable erections. The more he loves and respects his wife, the harder it is for him to fuck her. In Stephen's mind, emotional security requires a constant monitoring of any selfish or aggressive inclinations. This belief, which grew out of his love for his mother, has become part of his sexuality. The more he loves Rita, and the more he depends on her, the greater his need for caution, and the more inhibited he is sexually. He doesn't know how to experience the open range of lust in the context of emotional care. His unconscious is loyal to the past. For Dylan, a retail manager in his 20s, emotional security feels altogether impossible, with or without sexual excitement. His mother, who died when he was 12, was the emotional linchpin of their family. When his eyes filled with tears at her funeral, his father said to him, "I hope you're not going to fall apart on me." In order to stay close to his father, he had to excise his entire emotional life. He explains, "All feelings were a sign of weakness in our house. The minute Dylan has feelings for someone, he lashes out at himself with self-loathing, hoping to control his unbearable vulnerability. His solution? Twice a week he goes to the clubs to pick up men he will never know and who, more important, will never know him. In anonymous sex there are no feelings, and Dylan is protected from repeating the humiliations of his childhood. At the same time, he gets to experience the delicious thrill of being wanted, being chosen by many at once." One aspect of the erotic blueprint that illustrates the irrationality of our desire is that what excites us most often arises from our childhood hurts and frustrations. The sex therapist Jack Morin explains that the erotic imagination is ingenious in undoing, transforming, and redressing the traumas of the past. In other words, the experiences that caused us most pain in childhood sometimes become the greatest sources of pleasure and excitement later on. Let's take a look at Melinda. Her father is a philanderer, and while she empathizes with her mother's despair, she also doesn't want to be like her mother, broken, miserable, bereft. Instead, she has become the seductress, the opposite of the abandoned wife. Melinda sets out to best men at their own game. Desire is stoked by unavailability in Melinda's mind, and once she seduced a man, he is instantly less attractive. In order to reconfirm her power, she must set her sights on the next man, and the next, and the next. If there's no obstacle to clear, she has no way to gauge her value. Almost nothing is more exciting than conquering a powerful, aloof man, but the ultimate thrill is in dumping him, sure proof that she has avenged her past. In heartlessly dismissing these men, Melinda seeks to confirm that, unlike her mother, she is strong and independent, the one calling the shots, making the choices, picking up or discarding lovers as suits her fancy. Of course, by ruthlessly purging vulnerability from her life, she perversely ends up just as lonely and unloved as her mother. The central agent of eroticism is the human imagination, But for many people, the project of sexual self-discovery is hampered by parental messages that induce fear, guilt, and mistrust. Something that is meant to protect children often turns out to be a source of much anxiety in adult sexual love. Lena grew up with a roster of what is and is not acceptable for a worthy woman to dream about, act on, and get off on. The eldest daughter in a conservative, devoutly religious household, Lena learned that decent women hewed to strict standards of womanly behavior were never aggressive or pushy, and always put the needs of others before their own. Like her mother and centuries of women before her, Lena has derived her self-esteem and validation from being a giver and not a taker. By making herself indispensable, she has hoped to counteract the vagaries of love. But Lena's niceness is precisely what turns her husband off. Her coy lovemaking and her lack of sexual assertiveness inhibit him. In recent months, Lena has started to wonder what her marriage would be like if she were less accommodating. She's experimenting with the idea that she might be liked for who she is, not only for what she gives. Together, we have been deconstructing the anxiety, guilt, and self-abnegation that are the legacy of the nice girl. Lena would love to become bold enough not only to know what she likes, but to be able to ask for it. Buying lingerie at Victoria's Secret with her husband may not sound like much, but for Lena, it was as uplifting as a Wonder Bra. The internal tensions that crackle in the sexuality of Stephen, Dylan, Melinda, and Lena are a result of childhood conflicts. The details of our erotic proclivities and apprehensions are refined throughout our lives, but often originate in our childhood experiences, both good and not so good. Sometimes it takes a bit of psychological sleuthing to make sense of all this, but very little in one's erotic imagination is happenstance. Me in the context of we. Our physical and emotional dependence on our parents surpasses that of any other living species in both magnitude and duration. It is so complete and our need to feel safe is so profound that we will do anything not to lose them. We will suppress our wishes and push our aggression underground. We will take the blame for abuse, submit to control, become self-reliant, and otherwise renounce our needs. In short, we'll apply a wide range of self-preservation tactics, all aimed at maintaining our primary bond. Things get tricky when you consider that one of our greatest needs, developmentally speaking, is autonomy. From the moment we can crawl, we navigate the treacherous path of separation in an attempt to balance our fundamental urge for connection with the urge to experience our own agency. We need our parents to take care of us, but we also need them to give us enough space to establish our freedom. We want them to hold us, and we want them to let us go. Throughout our lives, we grapple with this interplay between dependence and independence. How artfully we reconcile these needs as adults depends greatly on how our parents reacted to the stubborn duality in our little selves. It's important to point out that our parents' behavior, what they actually do, is only one part of the situation. Another part is our interpretation of their actions. Each child brings an individual resilience to the lottery of life. What might feel good to one will feel overwhelming to another. Some of us may wish our parents had been more involved, while others may cringe at memories of their parents' scrutiny and intrusion. Every family has its preferred responses to expressions of dependency and autonomy, when they are rewarded and when they are thwarted. In the give and take with our parents, we determine how much freedom we can safely experience and how much our connections will require the subjugation of our needs. In the end, we fashion a system of beliefs, fears, and expectations, some conscious, many unconscious, about how relationships work. We wrap these up in a tidy package and hand it out to our beloved. It is a fair trade. Not coincidentally, this entire emotional history plays itself out in the physicality of sex. The body is the purest, most primal tool we have for communicating. As Roland Barthes wrote, "What language conceals is said through my body. My body is a stubborn child. My language is a very civilized adult." The body is our mother tongue, our mediator with the world long before we speak our first words. From the moment we come into being, love flows from adult to child sensuously, and dare I say, erotically as well. Bodily sensations dominate our first awareness of our environment and our earliest interactions with our caregivers. The body is a memory bank for the sensual pleasures of the skin. How often do I hear men and women in my office implore each other, "Can you just hold me?" The soothing powers of a hug hold at 40, no less than at 5. The body is also a storage facility for the distress and the frustrations we have endured and the pain we have suffered. Cleverly, our bodies remember what our minds may have chosen to forget, both light and dark. Perhaps this is why our deepest fears and most persistent longings emerge in intimate sex. The immensity of our neediness, the fear of desertion, the terror of being engulfed, the yearning for omnipotence. Erotic intimacy is an act of generosity and self-centeredness, of giving and taking. We need to be able to enter the body or the erotic space of another without the terror that we will be swallowed and lose ourselves. At the same time, we need to be able to enter inside ourselves, to surrender to self-absorption while in the other's presence, believing that the other will still be there when we return, that he or she won't feel rejected by our momentary absence. We need to be able to connect without the terror of obliteration, and we need to be able to experience our separateness without the terror of abandonment. The selfishness of intimate pleasures. I have always been interested in the people who are able to achieve balance between self and other on an emotional level, but who repeatedly fail to achieve it physically. The threat of merging in the physical act of sex and the ensuing loss of self is so intense for these people that they defend against it either by shutting down sexually or by taking their desire elsewhere. The psychoanalyst Jessica Benjamin writes, "The child's struggle for autonomy takes place within the realm of the body and its pleasures. It is no different for the adult." The first time James walked into my office, he sat down and said, "Stella and I have a very good marriage, but sex has always been a problem." James feels sexually inhibited with Stella, and their erotic misfit fills him with tension. Whatever initial excitement he may feel when Stella approaches him invariably turns into a preoccupation with his own performance. Will I stay hard? Will I come too soon? Will Stella have an orgasm? Sex becomes a race to the finish line. Can he get there before he loses his erection? His ability to enjoy himself is massively curtailed by this narrow focus. He can't be playful, can't try out new things, because anything that strays from the routine might jeopardize his capacity to perform. These anxieties always have a ripple effect, and James's inhibitions have also stifled Stella. She senses his absence, laments his lack of attention, and has complained about it bitterly over the years. "Tell me about your mother," I asked James. "My mother? You don't waste a minute, do you? A few years ago I went to see a therapist and she also wanted me to talk about my mother. It didn't change a thing. My wife is nothing like my mother." In due diligence, I always go back to the source. I promise I won't tell you that you married your mother. But the first place we learn about love and relationships is in our original family. None of the others, friends, flings, teachers, lovers, can carry this kind of emotional resonance. So, tell me about your mother. What emerges in our conversations is that James was keenly attuned to his mother's moods, and she was often lonely and sad. She didn't like noise, didn't like messes, and got agitated when he and his sisters were too boisterous. She was a good mother, but very tightly wound. I always found it difficult to handle the specifications of her needs. She needed 72 things lined up to be okay. James's mother relied on him for support, company, and conversation. She referred to his father as simply the paycheck. When I was older and wanted to do things with my friends, I knew she was disappointed. She'd say, "Have a good time," in a way that made it very hard for me to have a good time. James grew up torn between his desire not to displease his mother and his need to lead his own life. Getting a scholarship to Stanford clear across the country was the best thing that could have happened to me. She couldn't deny me that opportunity. I left, but I took a lot of guilt with me. The first time James set his eyes on Stella, she was a vision. Everything about her was graceful, vibrant, colorful. She was a woman who was not afraid to stand out. She was all light. Stella was the antithesis of James's mother, and for the first time he was able to love a woman and not feel burdened with responsibility and guilt. In fact, Stella regularly rejected his attempts to be overly accommodating, explaining that they made her feel smothered. He laughs when he recounts how anxious he used to feel when he wanted to do something that didn't include her. He was always afraid of disappointing her. He had a way of asking, "Do you mind?" that drove her crazy. Finally, she snapped, "Look, I'm not your mother. You don't have to ask my permission." Stella has taught James, largely through example, that you can be close to someone, intimate, caring, secure, without feeling sacrificed in the process. In asserting her independence, Stella has communicated over and over that she is not fragile and that her well-being does not depend exclusively on him. The price of love doesn't have to be personal obliteration. In many ways, James and Stella have an enviable marriage. They enjoy each other. He still makes her laugh out loud, and she's the fiercest but most trusted critic of his graphic design work, and as he would add, everything else too. Stella, clear about where she stands, says, "Even when I hate his guts, I've never been bored. The day I'm bored, I'm out of here." In the 31 years they've been together, they've raised 4 children, renovated 2 houses, suffered the loss of all 4 of their parents, survived Stella's breast cancer, and toasted the birth of their first grandchild. This is the bright side of their story. But in the middle of this pastoral landscape is the minefield of sex, where their worst arguments occur. She wants it, he doesn't. She wants to talk about it, he doesn't. She gets angry, he gets defensive. They clash, then wait for the dust to settle. The situation is chronic and relentless, and recently it got a lot worse. For years, Stella has resented being the custodian of their sex life. "I'm the one who thinks about it, who wants it, who makes it happen, and who complains when it doesn't. If I left it up to James, our erotic life would be a desert." Privately, James admits that he initiates only when he's reasonably sure she won't be receptive. That way, he appears to keep up his end of the bargain. Stella hates being the one who does it all, but she doesn't dare stop for fear that there will be nothing, an unbearable void. Better to assume his lack of interest than to confirm it. Since Stella entered menopause, her sex drive has plummeted and her worst fears have in fact been confirmed. James's lack of sexual initiative, once cloaked by her eagerness, is now glaring. She feels frantic at the prospect of sexual deadness that looms before her. "We're like roommates. This time I really need him to make the effort, and he won't." I point out to Stella that even though it may look as if he won't, what's more likely is that he doesn't know how. The disruption brought about by menopause challenges a pattern that has been fixed since early in their relationship. They will soon discover that it also opens up new possibilities. James is quick to focus on performance issues to justify his lack of desire. He foresees sexual failure, and his anxiety makes this prophecy self-fulfilling. He feels diminished and unmanly each time he fails, and his fear of impotence makes him want to stop even before he starts. The unintended irony in all this is that James becomes so obsessed with doing it right, staying hard for Stella, that he loses sight of her entirely. So while he thinks he's focusing completely on her, she feels as if he's somewhere else altogether. This has been a point of contention between them. I remarked to James that holding the lens squarely on the physical act of sex, sex as a performance, is a decidedly unerotic approach. It is too narrow an angle. To me, it seems that James is overwhelmed by the whole prospect of being sexual with his wife, claiming desire, eroticizing her, feeling free to express the bawdiness of his lust with her. So when I ask James if he ever experiences anxiety-free sex, he answers, "Only when I masturbate." This is important since it confirms for me that he has no organic difficulty and that, genitally speaking, he can perform just fine. In solitary sex, James can attend to himself without the pressure of another's demands. The women who populate his fantasies are lascivious, sexually alluring, and in no way vulnerable. He need not fear that his selfishness might hurt them, and he can delight in his excitement guilt-free. This is a freedom he never reaches with his wife, and that realization leads us to the cause of his erotic block. James doesn't know how to enjoy himself sexually in the presence of the woman he loves. Unable to reconcile pleasing himself and pleasing Stella at the same time, he ends up pleasing neither. Even though emotionally and intellectually he is able to maintain a strong sense of himself with his wife, he hates her taste in music, refuses to wear Italian suits, and defied her by voting Republican one year, this self-possession breaks down in the sexual encounter. He fears that if he surrenders to his own concupiscence and forgets Stella, even for a moment, she will be unforgivably hurt. Though James is not aware of this, his erotic blueprint is riddled with marks left by his relationship with his unhappy mother. When it comes to sex with Stella, he is right back to the setup he had in his childhood. He has to make an impossible choice between attending to himself and securing closeness. The guilt he felt as a child about being selfish has been transformed into sexual inhibition. Perhaps this is why James experiences his wife's desire as a demand rather than an invitation. It's an obligation, not a seduction. Eroticism has shifted into the realm of duty and is weighed down with pressure, guilt, and worry, all proven anti-aphrodisiacs. Rekindling desire. James and Stella are stumped. Their sex problem has been chalked up to lousy chemistry, and they think it is as permanent and irreversible as an amputated leg. For years, James has been stuck in a narrative of helplessness that goes something like this. Our problem has to be coming from somewhere. It has to be somebody's fault. And if it's not my fault, then whose fault is it? Must be Stella. Let's blame her. Reinterpreting James's lack of desire, I locate it firmly in the reverberations of his childhood. He begins to have some compassion for himself. At the same time, I challenge him to take responsibility for it in the present. Together, we disentangle self-blame and responsibility and map out courses of action. This brings him big relief. For Stella, this new line of attribution is a small step toward restoring her sense of self-esteem. I work with James to establish a comfortable sense of sexual separateness, making sure to clarify that separateness doesn't mean indifference. Instead of fixating constantly on Stella, I ask him to do the unthinkable and hold on to himself. With this in mind, I suggest a few things. First, leave the bedroom. Too many bad associations. Curse the bed. It has failure written all over it. It operates as a sensory deprivation tank. Find other surfaces in the house. Then, I'd like you to masturbate next to Stella, to experience the possibility of pleasing yourself in her presence. Take note of the tension and the guilt. Be mindful of them, rather than trying to avoid them. I chose masturbation for several reasons. First, it is the one area of James's sexuality where he can let go freely. Second, it invites him to be totally self-centered and relieves him of the responsibility of pleasing his wife. Third, it will, I hope, confirm for him that attending to himself doesn't have to hurt her. Being watched will support his ability to indulge his erotic individuality guilt-free. Finally, it will turn his performance anxiety on its head. The act of masturbating in her presence is itself a grand performance with Stella as the sole spectator. For the first time, he can consider that she may actually enjoy taking in his enjoyment. Letting her watch him roam freely in his own erotic territory is itself an intimate gift. Each of these layers helps to create a reality that is entirely different from the one he felt with his mother. After all, we don't masturbate in front of our parents, but we can with our lovers. Of course, when I made this suggestion, I considered Stella's plight as well. When James touches her tentatively, waiting for her to give him the go-ahead, she is filled with resentment. As it turns out, James's cautious regard is a turn-off. His deference leaves her feeling burdened. His dogged focus leaves her aching. Earlier in our conversation, James made a point of telling me that Stella had a temper. While that may be so, I confirmed, if you had made love to her more often, you would have a wife with a very different temper. Because the frustration that people can experience when the body is not touched, stroked, held, and pleasured drives people up a wall. What you then get is arousal transformed into rage. I tell Stella what I've told many people who are cherished spouses but famished lovers. You know he loves you. You've never doubted that. And that's why you've stayed all these years. What hurts so much is that you've never felt wanted by him. You feel that it's all on you to make it happen, and indeed it is. You forfeited sensual complicity for emotional security. It's a cruel bargain. Like a glacier suddenly melting, tears roll down Stella's face. They speak volumes about the longing and rejection she's lived with for so long. It's virtually impossible not to take such repeated denial personally, to see it as proof that one is undesirable, and to slip into self-doubt. To James, I say, love and desire are not the same. Cozy is not the same as sexy. Your wife knows you love her. What she wants is to feel desired by you. She wants to know your hunger, to taste the delicate flavors of your craving, and to see it as a match for her own. Your inability to let go, to surrender to your own hedonistic designs, is infuriating to her. Your passivity is irritating, and your considerateness is the opposite of her fantasy of unrestrained rapture. Your lustiness would be an open endorsement for her ardor. It's hard to let go with someone who doesn't. The masturbation experiment was only a partial success. It went so-so, as these things sometimes do, but there was no dramatic transformation. James' self-consciousness got the better of him. He had always marshaled masturbation as a private pleasure, and he had no desire to share it. But what happened a few days later was a real turning point. James and Stella had a row. She was upset, convinced that things would never change. His first impulse was to hold her, but he was afraid that it wasn't what she wanted. She seemed so angry with him. But he pushed through his awkwardness and held her anyway. Though she wasn't responsive at first, he maintained his embrace. In the past, James had always retreated, focusing solely on her cues for readiness. He was organized by her. This time, he made his own choice, laid claim to his own feelings, and was surprisingly aroused. He rubbed her neck, and she began to calm down. She knew he was there, and that he could contain her. He could withstand her intensity. One intensity dominoed another, and this led to what they both recounted separately as wonderful lovemaking. Theirs wasn't an ecstatic fulfillment. Rather, they reveled in a quiet passion, the simple understanding of two bodies reunited after a long absence. It takes two people to create a pattern, but only one to change it. James gleefully described himself in a later session as bold and persistent, and was amazed by how the feeling of being in charge literally charged him up. By taking control, he was finally able to lose control. The sexual prison he and Stella had carefully constructed had begun to unlock. Freeing himself from his chronic reactive stance, even momentarily, filled him with hope and gave him a glimpse into the erotic possibilities that lay ahead. For the first time in years, he found himself fantasizing about his wife. What they might do together, where they might do it. He reclaimed a part of himself that had been completely lost in anxiety. It's worth pointing out that in this encounter and subsequent ones, James had no problem with coming too soon, or even with worrying that he might. When sex feels like an obligation, it's very efficacious to come fast. It brings a quick end to the discomfort. When lovers engage sexually as free agents, turning surrender into an act of self-assertion, there is no need to get it over with. Precipitating the grand finale isn't so much the point as savoring the mutual trust and intimacy along the way. Premature ejaculation is a misnomer. It's not a matter of timing. It has to do with lack of intent. It would be better described as involuntary ejaculation. Once James was in charge of his desire, he was in charge of his ejaculation as well. In an interesting twist to the saga, James also told me that each time he and Stella have made love since beginning therapy, it has been after an argument. I'm a little bothered by that, he confessed. I'd like for us to be able to make love without preceding it with whatever that is. Anger and excitement have a complicated relationship, I explain. Physiologically, anger and arousal have a lot in common. Psychologically, too. In your case, I think the anger emboldens you. It relieves you of compliance and leaves you feeling more entitled. Anger highlights separateness and is a counterpoint to dependence. This is why it can so powerfully stoke desire. It gives you the distance you need. As a habit, it can be problematic, but there's no denying that it's a powerful stimulant. Over the years, I've met more than a few people like James and Stella. Couples whose otherwise colorful relationship teeters on the brink of sensual austerity. Together we investigate the emotional undercurrents of their erotic stagnation. We trace the origins of the blocks as well as the relational dynamics that keep them in place. They find it useful to begin this way and are comforted to learn that understanding the past can help them change the present. The importance of being ruthless. We commonly believe that the closer we feel to someone, the easier it will be to shed our inhibitions. But that's only half the story. Intimacy does nurture desire, but sexual pleasure also demands separateness. Erotic excitement requires that we be able to step out of the intimate bond for a moment, turn toward ourselves, and focus on our own mounting sensations. We need to be able to be momentarily selfish in order to be erotically connected. Our ability to step away from our loved ones while trusting their steadfastness is forged in the security of our childhood bonds. The more we trust, the farther we are able to venture. When infants play peekaboo, the distance they can bear is only as far as the breadth of their fingers. What powers the game is the realization that even when I don't see you, you continue to exist. Older children play hide-and-seek, securing the knowledge that someone will eventually come looking. The thrill of hiding is followed by the relief of being found. Erotic intimacy is an adult version of hide-and-seek. As when we were children, the stronger the connection, the braver we are about stretching it. We know our beloved will be waiting for our return, will not punish our selfish pursuits, and in fact may even applaud them. In his book Arousal, Michael Bader links the idea of selfishness to the concept of sexual ruthlessness, which he defines as the quality of desire that enables a person to surrender to the full force of his or her own rhythms of pleasure and excitement without guilt, worry, or shame of any kind. Bader's explanation emphasizes the importance of differentiation, the capacity to hold on to oneself in the presence of another. Without that ability, we become like James, who can't get out of Stella's head long enough to experience his own fervor. The rawness of our desire can feel mean, bestial, even unloving. Eros can feel predatory, a voracious grab. Whatever guilt we feel about taking, whatever shame we feel about our wantonness, our passion, our indecency, is intensified in the primitive vulnerability of sex. We bring to our intimate erotic encounters a lifetime of injunctions against selfishness in the context of love, the specifics of which are detailed in our erotic blueprint. In addition to the family legacy, we also carry a cultural legacy. We are socialized to control ourselves, to restrain our impulses, to tame the animal within. So as dutiful citizens and spouses, we edit ourselves and mask our ravenous appetites and conceal our fleeting need to objectify the one we love. For many people, the prohibitions against ruthlessness within the context of a loving relationship are just too great to allow for erotic abandon. The self-absorption inherent in sexual excitement obliterates the other in a way that collides with the ideal of intimacy. Such people find that they can be safely lustful and intemperate only with people they don't know as well, or care about as much. Recreational sex, pornography, and cybersex all share an element of distance, even anonymity, that avoids the burdens of intimacy and makes sexual excitement possible. Clearly, these emotionally disengaged situations are more often found outside the home, where the need for differentiation is less intense. Being with an unavailable partner provides a protective limit. If you can't get too close to a person, you need not fear entrapment or loss of self. To my thinking, cultivating a sense of ruthlessness in our intimate relationships is an intriguing solution to the problems of desire. While it may appear at first glance to be detached and even uncaring, it is in fact rooted in the love and security of our connection. It is a rare experience of trust to be able to let go completely without guilt or fretfulness, knowing that our relationship is vast enough to withstand the whole of us. We reach a unique intimacy in the erotic encounter. It transcends the civility of the emotional connection and accommodates our unruly impulses and primal appetites. The flint of rubbing bodies gives off a heat not easily achieved through tamer expressions of love. Paradoxically, ruthlessness is a way to achieve closeness. Erotic intimacy invites us into a state of unboundedness where we experience a sweet freedom. We get a temporary break from ourselves, the legacies of our childhood, the habits of our relationship, and the constraints of our respective cultures. Loving another without losing ourselves is a central dilemma of intimacy. Our ability to negotiate the dual needs for connection and autonomy stems from what we learned as children and often takes a lifetime of practice. It affects not only how we love, but also how we make love. Erotic intimacy holds the double promise of finding oneself and losing oneself. It is an experience of merging and of total self-absorption, of mutuality and selfishness. To be inside another and inside ourselves at the same time is a double stance that borders on the mystical. The momentary oneness we feel with our beloved grows out of our ability to acknowledge our indissoluble separateness. In order to be one, you must first be two.